So what we're doing this morning is I'm going to just talk for a bit, and then we're going to watch a video of an interview between an Indian old man called Mahavir and Bhante about Ambedkar. That will be about 25 minutes, and we're going to finish with a puja, celebrating Ambedkar and the mass conversions at the end. So I think what I want to talk about really. I'd heard quite a lot about Ambedkar through the years of being involved in Tri Ratna, and obviously had responded to that. But it was when I went to India for the first time in 2013 that it really hit me, really hit home. I remember sitting on the train from Delhi to Gaya, just looking out the window and seeing, you know, the landscape, and seeing. One of the sights that particularly struck me was a woman sitting, working with baskets of rocks by the train, alongside the train, and their kids, you know, little sort of toddlers and small babies, were just sort of sitting on the stone, on the bare stone, very close to the wheels of the trains rumbling by. These were obviously the poorest of the poor, and the women who had to work such really dangerous and menial and physically demanding labour, because of course they were very low caste, and that was the only opportunities open to them. So caste is illegal in India nowadays, but there's a difference between something being illegal and something not being part of the way people think or function. That takes longer. One of the things that Ambedkar said was, caste is not a physical object like a wall of bricks or a line of barbed wire. Caste is a notion. It's a state of the mind. The destruction of caste does not therefore mean the destruction of physical barrier. It means a notional change, a change in mind, a change in mentality. So from that, I'd like you to imagine that you are you. Imagine that you are you, but you've been born under very different circumstances. You've been born in a slum, perhaps. You've been born in a low-caste family. You've been born, the dwelling place is made of, if you're lucky, corrugated iron or something like that. There are open sewers in the slums, and these are packed, tight, close, people living, you know, very, very tightly packed, close. And so, you know, if you're lucky, you will survive babyhood, childhood. Of course, the child mortality is hugely, you know, it's very, very high under those conditions. If you're lucky, you'll survive. And your family has the opportunity, your mother, your father work. They might work at breaking stones, lifting, carrying stones. They might work at rag picking. You might join them when you're very young, as a child, on the rubbish heaps picking rags. They might work at carrying away the excrement from buildings. That's a job for the lower castes. And you might find, certainly earlier in the last century, that if you were close to higher caste Hindus, they would avoid you. You had to avoid them because your shadow would pollute them. This is a condition that the lower caste, the Dalit people, grew up with. And not only was this a social, their place in society, it was sanctioned by their religion. In fact, I believe it said in the in one of the scriptures that if a Dalit person heard the Vedas, they had to have hot blood poured in their ear because it was pollutant. Even to, you know, it's. So the religion that you're born into teaches that your duty in life is to accept the caste that you're born into, to work as well and as hard as you can within that caste, and you might, in that case, if you do that, you'll be reborn into a higher caste. So the religion taught that it was not your place to try and improve your status. Your place was to accept your status. So this is the conditions that you've been born into. And you come to hear that there is somebody, there's a man called Bhimrao Ambedkar, who was born into exactly these conditions, exactly this status. He was a bright boy, and he gained an education, unlike probably you and most other people in your past, by sitting outside the door and listening to the lessons, because he wasn't allowed in the classroom, because his presence would have polluted the others. But nonetheless, he overcame that. He overcame that to the extent of going to college, to university, going eventually to... He was sponsored, because he was such a bright boy, he was sponsored by, I think it was a local Maharaja. Anybody remember? Yeah. And he went to England to study law, where, of course, the social situation at that time wasn't particularly kind to people with his colour skin, so he did meet up with a lot of racism. And he was extremely intelligent, extremely talented, and in fact could have made a very good living for himself and led a very comfortable life through practising law, but he couldn't do that. He was totally committed to the uplift of his people, because he felt that the degradation of these people affected the whole of society. It wasn't just the Dalits that were degraded. So he worked his way up. He became a lawyer, and he became involved in politics. All the time that this is happening, he is working against the fact that the higher caste people that he's working with and associating with still find it maybe hard to, well, drink from the same vessel that he's drunk from. And, so, you know, daily humiliations of that kind. He became the law minister for the new Indian government. He wrote the constitution for the new state of India. And in doing so, Ambedkar was by no means a general sort of character. You can imagine that he wouldn't be growing up under those conditions. He was a fierce sort of character. He needed to be to withstand the sort of pressures that he was under. He clashed very strongly with Gandhi. Gandhi had a different perspective on how to help the lower caste. In fact, it's quite a complex political issue, but there was the... at one point, it was part of the constitution that Muslims could have a special status, and Ambedkar thought that the lower caste, the Dalit people, should also have a special status, have special privileges because of the degree of their, you know, how much they needed it. Gandhi disagreed with this. He felt that the lower caste were a problem for the Hindu religion, and it was up to the higher caste Hindus to help the lower caste. Ambedkar's belief was that they needed the freedom to determine and administer and organise themselves. So this was actually quite a major sort of disagreement between them. And Gandhi, actually, one of his fasts was related to this area, this kind of issue, related to untouchable Dalit people, and which Ambedkar thought was an extremely... acting very much in power mode. Because if Gandhi had died of this fast, there would have been bloodshed, there would have been, you know, there would have been massacres of the Dalit people. He felt that it was a use of power. I believe he succeeded in the stance that he took, and over the years, one of the things that he felt very strongly was that the religion that the caste system was enshrined by was something that he didn't want to participate in. He said, "I may be born a Hindu, but I will not die a Hindu." He investigated what religion he might convert to, because he did at the same time feel that a religious basis for society was necessary. He didn't feel that social change was enough if it wasn't rooted in some kind of vision that went beyond the mundane. It needed to be rooted in a vision of humanity, of human potential. And so he did study and look at all the potential religions, and Buddhism was the one that appealed to him, because first of all, it appealed to his reason. He felt that religion needs to be reasonable, it needs to be demonstrable. And secondly, because it enshrined values of equality and metta, maitri. Maitri he saw as the basis of all morality. Maitri is metta, what we call metta. So after some years, he decided that he was going to make a conversion to Buddhism. And this is what we're celebrating today, that particular event. There was a long, long, long lead up to this, and a long period of time when he was, would have considered himself a Buddhist. But possibly he knew how, he wasn't a well man, he'd exhausted himself really through his hard work. I wonder if, I'm speculating, he knew that he didn't have that long to live. And so he, on today?
Yesterday.
15th, yeah. Today's the 15th? Mm-hmm. Okay, so on the 14th of November 1956, he took.
October.
Yeah, it's October. Thank you. He took the refuges and precepts from a bhikkhu called U Chandramani. As it happened, at that time he'd already started to correspond with Sangharakshita. Our teacher, Sangharakshita. They both wrote articles about Buddhism in Buddhist magazines, and Ambati had written to Ambedkar praising an article that he'd written, and he wrote back, and this was the first letter that he wrote back, where he writes about how important it is that the bhikkhu should work hard for Buddhism and to uplift the Dalit people. Bhante at that time had founded an organisation in Kalimpong called the Young Men's Buddhist Association, and Ambedkar said, "It's good that you founded the YMBA. You should be more active than that." So the end of Ambedkar's first letter to Bhante, there was an exhortation that, you know, he should work harder, do more. I've seen some footage, newsreel footage of the conversion of his ceremony, which he took the refuges and precepts. And what's very, very clear is that this was a profoundly moving occasion for Ambedkar. In those photographs, there are photographs of. There is one down the bottom there where he's bowing to the Buddha. It's a very poor photograph. It's him and his wife bowing to the Buddha, but somehow I find that very moving. And he spoke to the 600,000 Dalit people that were gathered there that day, and he spoke to them. And he gave them 22 vows to follow. And the first of these are that to do with the Hindu religion, that they completely and utterly repudiated the Hindu religion. It's as if he really saw that in order to accept Buddhism, you have to let go of what you've been, you know, the conditionings of the past. So these vows, they also enshrined ideals of compassion and humanity and so forth. Because Ambedkar saw that any social revolution begins in the mind of human beings, begins in the change of a change of consciousness. As he says there, cultivation of the mind should be the ultimate aim of human existence. And I think I want to come back to this, you know, ourselves growing up, perhaps as a, imagining ourselves in a position growing up as a Dalit at that time, where our involvement in religion would have been worshipping gods, or certain gods, you know, daily pujas and so forth to these gods, who I suppose were at the top, you know, the top rung of, you know, what they were at the bottom rung of. So that was their participation in religion. And what Buddhism represented must have been an entirely revolutionary concept. Not that you're not unworthy, that you're not pollutant, that you're a human being capable of enlightenment. That's basically the teaching of the Buddha. You're a human being capable of dignity, of growth, of development, of self-responsibility. And this wasn't just a bunch of ideas. It was practices as well. After this conversion, Ambedkar actually died 6 weeks later, and his followers were plunged into dismay. He had led them in this massive movement to leave Hinduism. He was their teacher. He was, for many of them, their friend. He was their example. He was, you know, he was their leader. And he died. What were they going to do? At that point, Sangharakshita, who had already formed this relationship with Ambedkar. In fact, Ambedkar had wanted Sangharakshita to be the monk officiating at the conversion ceremony, but Sangharakshita thought, he refused because he felt that Uchandramani was a more senior monk and he wanted to defer to seniority. But seeing this tremendous need, the dismay and despair that the people were in, Sangharakshita travelled to Nagpur. Well, he was in Nagpur already. He spent days and days and days going from place to place, giving talks, encouraging people, giving them confidence that they could practice the Dharma even without Ambedkar, giving them confidence that they needed to continue this massive movement that had begun, and giving them confidence in themselves. Sangharakshita didn't stay in India, but some years later, when he'd founded the what was then the Western Buddhist Order, some order members, Lokamitra first of all, decided to go out to India and basically go on a yoga course. And Abhante said to him, "Well, why are you there? Look up some old friends." And Lokamitra went out, he looked up these old friends, and immediately knew that the people there were crying out for the Dharma teaching. And that is really the start of TBMSG in India. The other order members joined him, and they gradually, Indians were ordained and so forth. Nowadays, I'm afraid I don't know how many order members.
600.
Thank you. 600 order members in India.
10,000 mitras.
And 10,000 mitras. Well. And One of the things that struck me very much when I visited to go on the audit convention was that the people, the first generation order members, those who had been ordained by Bhante and other Mansabhuti, well, there was the first generation who in a way came from those early days, the mass conversions. But then there were their families and their children who were becoming university educated, they were educated, setting up businesses, just the way, the change that has happened in the lives of people who have been involved in the Buddhist conversion has been absolutely remarkable, and it has been effected peacefully. This is one of the major sort of characteristics. There has been in India a lot of religious violence that's unfortunate, but these changes have been peaceful, and I can't help to think that that's because they've been based on Dharma practice, they've been based on Maitri. There's so much more I could say, but I don't know if you want to just...
Yeah, yeah. I suppose I just wanting to drop the lack of confidence that the Dalit community experience, just because they've been downtrodden. I just want to give an example of they're not allowed to drink from the same well. So if you go out in the village and it's not running water, you have to collect water from maybe the tank, as it's called, the reservoir, or the one tap in the village, or the one well in the village. They were untouchable. The Dalits were expected to wait for higher caste Hindus to give them water from the well, and sometimes they would have to wait hours. So it's just water to wash, water to drink, and so on. I think it was back in the 20s, Dr. Ambedkar, as a sort of symbol of actually, no, this is not right, he led a mass protest of the Dalit community in one area. I can't remember the name, but it's a very famous occasion. All they did was they went to this reservoir on the outskirts of the town, and they drank from the reservoir. And this polluted the reservoir, the fact that they drank from it. So not only there was a massive reprisals in terms of violence and killings in retribution, to repurify this tank, what was poured in was, I can't remember the quantity, but vast quantities of cow urine, cow dung, ghee, milk into this water supply, and that would purify it from the touch of these human beings. Mm. So can you imagine, and that's just one example.
Yeah.
So can you imagine the effect on your psyche? You are considered less pure than a cow. I mean, I have nothing against cows, but it's just like the unbelievable nature of the fact that you are worth less than a cow. And so that just the effect that of hundreds and hundreds of years of that sort of treatment.
Yeah.
And so just how radical it was to be for people to be told they could practice the Dharma, they could change. Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that you reflect on, I suppose, is what's the relevance to us of Ambedkar and the change? And I think that one of the things that's very strongly, the message that comes across very strongly, is that all change starts by a change of mind, a change of consciousness. That for the Dalit people, it started with a confidence that they could change, that they were worthy, that they were they could take responsibility for their own destiny. And I think that this is a message for us as well, that whatever change we want to see in society, we need to start by embodying it, by living it with our own minds, in our own community, in our own lives, and that can be powerful. That is powerful. It's enormously powerful. Ambedkar's very strong message was that it's the duty of Buddhists to spread the Dharma. He said that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. And this can kind of go against maybe an idea that religion for us is a private matter. It's something something that we, you know, we sort of practice ourselves and don't bother other people with too much. But Ambedkar's belief was that the Dharma was for all, and that the ability to change our lives is something that we can share and spread. It doesn't mean pressurizing people, but it means making it available as widely as possible. I think that's all I want to say. We can watch the video and then we can do a puja. Okay.